October's free thinkers.
Okay, and we all know about our 80 peso, 80 peso spending obligation. And the bar's open till 6 if you want to delay that.
The expense.
I believe Jeff is going to give us a talk next month, right?
Happy to.
Happy to, and is going to decide it. He sent me a list of things, and I thought three of them were
yes.
Very interesting. So, okay.
Okay.
Now, this month, yeah, I was curious about a few things, actually. I was curious about whether free thinkers is a proselytizing movement. Are we... are we basically live and let live? You can believe what you want. Or is the consequence of irrational thought so dangerous globally now that we have an obligation to spread rationalism? So that's my first question of the day. I've got a few other things here, but I'd be interested to know just what people think about our duty or obligation to spread rationalism in an increasingly, or seemingly increasingly, irrational world.
He left off pessimist.
Hmm?
He left off pessimist.
Well, you know, whether you look at the glass as being half full or half empty, you know, we do recognize it as a container, containing the equation, and not some random illusion.
Well, the thing is, if that's our responsibility, it has to be possible. And I'm not even sure it's possible.
Okay.
You know about that effect, the more factual you get, the more entrenched your opposition becomes. So, you know, what could this do to bring up facts if it just makes them more opposed to you?
So you think proselytizing is a self-defeating exercise?
In fact, in the knee-jerk version, I think there's a way to do it. But it probably is like storytelling and potlucks and whatnot.
I've got there was some research on a Reddit community board. It's called Change My View.
And it's, I'd like to point out that, you know, there is two schools of thought. One is you're an ardent atheist, you're anti-theist. You speak out, and you know, Richard Dawkins and others are in that school, along with Ken Crosby. And then there's others that just say, live and let live. And,
yeah.
I think it's really almost innate in the individual atheist, whether they're an activist atheist or just I'm an atheist, but I don't care who knows it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't care what you think.
Do you think, though, that as the consequence of theistic irrational thinking is now going to impact the passive atheist? Without doubt.
Well,
you know,
for sure.
So
Richard Dawkins' approach to atheism and his evangelical approach certainly got atheism on the, have gotten us a name.
Yeah.
People
can't. Always a good name, but.
Yeah, not always good. But so I think the activists, atheists like them have done good.
Uh huh. Do you think it should be an imperative for the activist atheist to proselytize to the passive atheist? To say, well, we, you know, while ever we've got things like global warming denial,
right,
which, you know, will have an impact on everyone, whether you decide to live and let live, or whether you try and fight it, or whatever. I mean, so should those that are on the more active side be more aggressive and try and change the minds of the passive ones?
I think they should. But there might be a better approach. Instead of trying to convince my Catholic son that he should be an atheist, I can convince him that critical thinking is really important. And and global warming is the result. You believe in that as a result of critical thinking.
And you think it's still possible to be a critical thinker and a theist? And that sounds a little bit like arrogance on my part, you know, saying that, you know, that's not possible. It sounds a little arrogant.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there are some that consider themselves, set their position.
Absolutely.
Some theists that it is, you know, they have thought about
Absolutely.
It very critically.
Yeah.
And, you know, their conclusion, although it's different, comes from the same set of axioms, set of, you know, logical axioms that we employ.
Right.
Yeah, I think you have to realize where theism comes from, you know, as opposed to atheism and humanism, for that matter. You know, when most, in fact, I would dare say, all religious people are raised religious. And I think, I can't remember the exact times, but I know it's been figured out. If you're being implanted with some thought before a certain age, you know, no matter what you do, you can't lose it. You can become very smart, and yet you can't lose it. As a result, the high scientists, actual scientists, that are religious as well. Although
yes.
they do not proselytize as a rule because they realize that there is a part missing. I mean,
yeah. there's a consequence.
Yeah,
that,
right.
So, I think you can generalize that way, but I know many families that have kids were raised the same, and one's an atheist and one's religious. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, but this is what I'm trying to say. An atheist is someone who comes to that conclusion when they are able to think.
Yes.
Because we're all born atheists, right?
If they're...
We're all born atheists.
No, I know.
For the first 20 minutes.
For the first 20 minutes.
I'm a born again atheist. Because I was born into one and then I got hooked.
I think the answer to your question is yes and yes. I mean, you said the first question was, should we be live and let live, or should we go out and proselytize? And I think we go out and proselytize until we find somebody that can't be saved.
Uh-huh.
And then you just say, okay, I'll live and let live. And
okay.
then you just have to take it on a case-by-case
basis. So you think there's a limit to what we can do?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're never going to convert the Pope. So even though this Pope's pretty good compared to previous Popes, but he's going to believe in God no matter what you say.
That's true. Although, you know... You know, listening to him,
yeah,
it seems to me like, he's a, you know, the cracks are visible, you know?
He has a few doubts. Some doubts.
I'm sure he does. Yeah. I mean, Mother Teresa, you know, after her death, her letters, you know, reveals significant doubts in her faith. You know, if those can be exploited.
She was a real bitch, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you've read Hitchens, The Missionary Position on her, she's far from a saint.
She's far from Mother Teresa. She was far from Mother Teresa.
Yes.
Yeah, Penn and Teller, did you see their episode on Teresa and Gandhi and the Dalai Lama? That was just hilarious.
Yeah,
but supposedly very factual, too. But if you like your facts through humor, it's well worth it.
But it's difficult. When she was being canonized, one of the miracles she supposedly performed, I think that you have to have three, don't you?
Yeah.
Three miracles. One of them was during a making of a documentary, there wasn't enough light in the room to shoot the movie. And so, but because of the light that she emits, miraculously, it was perfect. Now,
you mean the clouds moved?
It was in the room. The light had gone, but the film still turned out okay. And it turned out that the cameraman had this new type of film that they'd never used before, and they put it in there and to see if it worked. You know, because they'd run out of film, they put this new Kodak. You know, this
higher speed.
Yeah. And they put it in there, and lo and behold, it worked. But it was Malcolm Muggeridge that really was
a miracle.
Well, the Kodak could produce something that worked.
That it actually worked.
You know, there's another aspect to that about whether you should proselytize or whatever. I'm an anti-theist. To a big extent, because the goddamned organized religion is costing me money.
That's another thing, yeah.
And it does have an impact. Money is power. Mm-hmm. And organized religion has power because they occupy such a privileged financial position in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the more power they have, the more privileges they will secure. And, in, you know, like owning politicians.
Yeah.
You have money, you own politicians. Yeah. And politicians make laws to in your favor. They elect, select Supreme Court judges who are likely to vote for you.
Well, they also, you know, go directly into your way of life. I mean, I never was aware of that until, you know, we were facing my wife's imminent death. She was clearly a candidate for euthanasia, I believe, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, but you can't do it, not in a Catholic country like this. No, I had to, you lived in Oregon, or someplace like that, for 6 months, you know. But here again, I mean, who the hell, well, these people have the right to tell us what to do, you know, with our own lives. So they have, I mean, that would be a justification for us.
I was hoping Stephen was going to be here today because I know he trolls some of the Christian boards out there, and I don't know whether I'm not sure whether he does it for fun, whether he does it to actually just needle these people, or whether he expects a change. I don't know. Does anyone know why he?
I think he trolls these mainly for fun.
But it's
for fun. Because I don't think it's changed any minds.
No.
I think he finds it interesting. It's almost a hobby to do that.
Exactly. There's some practical considerations. I'm thinking of my extended family. My brother, that's closest to my age, and myself are non-theists, atheists. And then I have several siblings. So I've got three brothers and a sister who are Christian. And they have a duty to procreate. And so in those numbers, you know, there were two of us and then there's four of them, they have over 30 kids. And Warren and I, my brother and I, we each had two because we thought that was the proper thing to do at the time that we were having children, you know, just replacing yourself. So the practical matter is when we go to family gatherings, there are, you know, over 50 of the Christians in my little extended family, and then there's, you know, six of us, eight of us.
Do you challenge them on anything?
Oh, sure. We have discussions, but, you know, it's eventually, you know, you have to let go because...
They're going to believe what they want to believe.
They're, you know, and once again, it's, you talked about, you know, the age when, I think, or somebody said there was an age beyond, if you get them up to a certain age, you've got them in your hand.
That's, I think, good. It was the Jesuits that claimed that.
And it seems to be bearing, you know, reality in the extended family. I don't think there's any of the children that have strayed. They had them, you know, from early on, you know, looking at, you know, now that's your Uncle Lloyd, you gotta be careful. Yeah, kind of stuff. And I gave him a book, Why Evolution, which was written by my cousin, who's also a non-theist, and trying to explain what it was so that they would understand what evolution was. I say, you know, there's no reason for your religious people to be against evolution. I mean, it's science. It makes sense. Look, but they were told not to even read or discuss that with me because that was, you know, a bad area. So they've got mind control. I'm just saying the practical thing is, if they have lots of children, which they do in the name of God, then they've got a lot more of them. And so we're fighting an uphill battle, and I don't think that very many of them are going to convert. I mean, I was born and raised a Christian, but I eventually decided it wasn't the way. And you know, there's some of us who get away, but I think the numbers are pretty small. I don't know what your experience is.
Well, I mean... Who here wasn't raised in some sort of religious household?
I wasn't.
You escaped it from sensible parents?
Well, my mother was Protestant, but never had been to church, but her family was, and my father was Catholic.
Yeah.
And they got married, and when I came along, I was the first one. They decided not to confuse matters. there was no word of any religious thing ever.
Okay.
But you're the exception, not the rule.
Well, I guess, yeah.
From here, you know, I was born in the Mormon church.
Oh, really? Okay.
And escaped that probably when I was about 14, and then really got out when I was,
yeah,
when I went to college, which opens your eyes.
Because I would imagine that Mormons, evangelicals, the fundamentalists are a little more harder to escape from than the Catholics, who are more, you know, rhinos, religion in name only. You know, they attend their services,
right?
But during the week, I mean, it's hard to describe
in the Mormon church.
Yes,
you're going to go to church about four times a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you're not.
And they're going to, I presume, they're going to live the life, right?
Yes. Well,
whereas, you know, come Monday, you know, even in Catholic countries, I mean, all the Catholics
drinking,
I know.
Drinking coffee or Coke is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And they live that, the word of wisdom, it's called. Yeah. And a lot of it is right. You know, coffee's caffeine, tobacco, nicotine. I mean, there's reasons for those.
Yeah.
Those things.
So when it comes to changing minds, what was the key what happened in your mind to reject Mormonism?
Just took philosophy classes, took, you know, college classes, and started thinking for myself and said, well, what a bunch of bullshit this is.
Basically,
you know, I have six siblings, myself and five others. And of the six, though, even though we were all raised in the Mormon church, and all except me stayed with the Mormon church for a long time, I left very early, myself, my sister, and both brothers are, while they won't say they're atheists, they say, you know, this is kind of nonsense.
But they've left the cult.
Only my two younger sisters stayed with the church.
Yeah.
So four out of six left. Some declared atheists.
Uh-huh.
Some say they are, but they won't say it.
Yeah.
And then a few are just kind of, well, agnostic probably more.
See, I think the best thing we could do to advance atheism is to convince the churches to be much more repressive.
Yeah.
I think the key is that people should start questioning, you know, and if you're talking to a religious person, rather than try and proselytize and say, you know, I have a better view than you, basically, just ask them questions. Why do you think you want to have all these children, you know?
Yeah.
Why this? Why, you know, and come and let them come up with answers.
They should have Catholic virginity tests just before marriage.
like others, I've argued with Christians and religious people a lot, and you argue right down to the point that it's faith.
Yeah.
And once they say that,
you're done.
The argument's over.
Right? But the thing is that we escaped it.
Well,
you know,
we're faith-free people.
You know, that's interesting.
Everybody says, prove it.
Yeah,
you know,
prove it. I don't have faith.
It
that's
seems
right.
Like
prove it.
It would have been a lot easier for me. For instance, you know, I started to disbelieve when I was about, let's say, 12, Sunday school. I asked the question, who wrote the Bible? I mean, it seems like pretty interesting, you know, it tells me what to do. Well, who wrote this, you know? And I never get an answer. But, you know, I never could run into anyone that was, say, an atheist and content with being an atheist. That would say, hey, you know, this guy's okay and he's an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's like, I don't know how you do it, but if there was that information easily available for anyone, you know, like, hey, you don't have to be a Christian. You know,
why did that question occur to you? Why is it not universal?
I don't know. It's...
Because your parents told you you're not allowed to ask that question.
But I presume we're all told that.
Right.
There's something.
Yeah.
There's something that some of us say, well...
That's bullshit.
That's bullshit.
Right.
But what? What influenced us?
That's a good question.
Well, I was wondering, you said you were a Mormon, so did you go to BYU, or did you go to some other institution of education?
I left home at an early age and joined the Navy. And then went to San Diego State University.
So they... And the people I've talked with, sometimes the people who seem to make the break, their family, the father, the mother, their, you know, grandpa or somebody is a little open to the world and says, hey, go out and learn. And these books are fine. You can look at this stuff. And so they have the freedom to investigate and ask questions. It seems like
I was
that's
at
part
a family reunion in Utah, and Me and my brother were talking. He was one of the non-believers but doesn't want to make a big deal out of it. And I had just read a study that said that the more educated you are, the less likely you're going to be a believer. And a few people overheard me. That's not true. That's not true. But it is true.
It is true.
And I think the more educated you become, the more you're a critical thinker. Of course, behind that is the desire to get educated and maybe the intellect to be educated. So, you know, I don't know what comes first.
I can't understand, you know, among religious educated people, if you really study the Bible, for instance, I mean, how could you read it and not pick up the discrepancies, you know, like, what did Jesus Christ say on the cross, you know? Like, there's two books that give different stories right there, you know, and that's a real fundamental difference. I mean, like, if you were educated studying this thing, how could you not question that?
Henry sent out a cartoon about that.
I don't remember what it was.
It was a cartoon about... You know, it was a quiz. You know, what did Jesus say on the cross? And it would, one would say this, one would say that. And,
oh, both are true.
And both are correct.
Yeah, it was just a long list of contradictions.
A long list of contradictions.
Yeah.
When my daughter was in school and went to a school that was very religious, very anti-gay, and that's how we, you know, got a bad name. But when she was in the classroom, all these supposed religious people, they were studying, you know, literature, and they would ask a question. Well, they had made a biblical reference. So what is this referring to? And she looks around the room, and there's no, you know, response from the Christians, supposed Christians. Okay, Karen, tell us what's the answer is, you know. So, because she knows Karen, a non-theist and well-read, and, you know, it turns out that many times the non-theists, and it's, I think it's been said many times, they seem to understand and have read the Bible more than the people who are the believers, because they hear the story from the preacher, or they, you know, they read little not the Bible but Bible stories books, and that's about their understanding, at least in that particular class at that time.
I think it has to do also with brain capacity. You know, some of us become footballers and make a fortune, you know, or boxers, and they, because they have a certain, you know, makeup, and you could go down the line, and when it comes to atheists, I think you don't find very many senile atheists.
Prison company.
Interesting observation.
I mean, you know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I became a member of the, you know, I lived in Chicago for a long time. And but I was already an atheist and a member of the ethical humanist, basically, well, was just called the humanist. And when I came, they gave me an address. It took me 5 years to actually become a member, and it wasn't for lack of trying. Uh-huh. But I mean, almost everyone, to a person, was a rather well-known scientist or somebody or another. The place was run by the guy who was a doctor in philosophy, I suppose. But he ran the Department of Comparative Religion at the University of Chicago. I mean, talking about heavy-duty brains, you know. Yeah. And so, but there were a whole bunch of people, you know, some of them had some rather significant, things to their name, chemists, you know, working in the drug industry and so on. And so, but like I said, they were just all very smart people. Mm-hmm. And so, and I at the time couldn't boast any college degrees. I got that later. Yeah, just to keep up with the Jones, basically. But so, you know, but they didn't think, you know, that I was going to fit right in.
Well, I had a, you know, part of the reason I, you know, wanted to talk about changing minds is a couple of things. If we take faith off the table, are there good strategies that we can use? Are there proven strategies that we can use to sort of start little cracks in the foundations of irrational thinkers?
Depends on the thinker.
Well, the second one was, this was a study done on whether you, what are the characteristics of an argument that has a better chance of changing someone's mind. So it's pretty short. The second one is and I'm a little concerned about this because I had a friend who was a therapist with cognitive behavioral therapy, which he claims works, and it is a very reputable therapy. But it seems to me, as someone who doesn't believe in free will, that it's all an exercise in pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Maybe you should believe in free will.
Or maybe if you just act as if you believe in free will, maybe that's what works. Anyway, this is a quick read about a study that was done. And it was from Cornell University. And it says a new paper from researchers at Cornell University shed some light on how and why people are convinced to change their minds. And the researchers analyzed nearly 2 years of postings on Change My View. It's a forum on the internet community Reddit, where posters present an argument and invite people to reason against them. So these arguments on Change My View range widely in terms of topics. People don't define who they are, their genetics environment do. Zoos are immoral. I think the vast majority of Bernie supporters are selfish and ill-informed. Reads one thread which received 1,125 comments in one day. So it is, well, you know, it's a good sample. So unlike the mindless clashes you often see on Twitter or Facebook, commenters on Change My View explain their reasoning at length. And the forum also requires the poster to let others know whether their view has changed by awarding the poster a delta, used to denote change, and explaining exactly what modified their view. And by looking at these exchanges, the researchers can study exactly what persuades people outside the laboratory and also have access to the mass quantities of data. So their research suggests that arguments end up changing people's minds of certain dynamics. They say numbers are important. The more people that try to persuade the original poster, the greater the likelihood of changing their view. So there is a certain persuasive element of the masses. So is timing. Those who write back first to the post, are more likely to persuade the original poster than those who write later. After 5 rounds of back and forth between the original poster and the challenger has virtually no chance of receiving a delta. So if you don't get them early, That's that. There are also significant differences in language between arguments that persuade and those that don't. The researchers find the factor most linked with successful persuading someone is using different words than the original post do, a sign that commentators are bringing in new points of view. They find that longer replies tend to be more convincing, as do arguments that use calmer language. The research suggests that using specific examples is a big help. Definite articles, the rather than a, are more present in persuasive arguments, suggesting that it helps to speak in specifics. Successful arguments use the phrases, for example, for instance, more often. Quotations and question marks don't appear to help the argument, but including links to supporting material does. Surprisingly, they find that hedging, using language like, it could be the case, is actually associated with more persuasive arguments. While hedging can signal a weaker point of view, the researchers say that it can also make an argument easier to accept by softening its tone. Finally, they argue that language tells us something about whether the person's mind can be changed in the first place. The researchers note that the language a person uses to express the original opinion shows to a great extent whether their opinion is malleable or not. They find that first-person pronouns, I, indicate an opinion is malleable, but first-person plural pronouns, we, suggest the opposite. Stubborn views expressed with more excitement, using decisive words like anyone, certain, and nothing, and superlative adjectives like worst and best. So the conclusion is, use these strategies when you argue. But remember that convincing someone of your point of view is no easy task. The researchers point out that even this Reddit forum, where people are expressly charged with being open-minded, opinions don't change in the majority of cases. And there was a quote at the beginning of this. Nothing in the world is harder than convincing someone of an unfamiliar truth. So, it seems like I think these posts are more reasoned arguments that are more prone to be changed.
Yes, and you're typing it out, so you you're not just spouting something off. You're thinking about it, and you're putting it in writing.
When I read this, the first thing that occurred to me was, is it possible to challenge the religious point of view's irrational thinking without challenging their religiosity? In other words, you know, don't challenge their views on God, but challenge their views on global warming. Challenge their views on homosexuality, but say, you know, yeah, and use their views against them. You know, did God create gays or not? You know, did God create us as stewards of the earth or not? You know, I mean, is it possible? And is it, does it matter in that case? If their impact is zero, because they're now thinking rationally, the fact that they still have that irrational part of them that wants to believe in a God, is that, have we fulfilled our obligation at that point?
Certainly helped, I think.
I would think we are. It's probably not just one thing that changed our minds. It's probably a number of things that we thought about and then said, oh. And then another one, oh. You know, so probably more things that you're thinking scientifically, logically about, then the more likely you might check that other area a little bit.
And what's more important, convincing them that global warming is real or God isn't? Which is going to have the biggest impact on the world.
Yeah. And can we use their arguments against them?
Absolutely.
You know.
Sure.
And say...
And it's more effective.
Yeah. You know, God put us in charge of this earth. And so therefore, you have a a religious obligation.
Yeah, and they're more likely to listen to you because you're saying God.
God will provide.
So but then it's always going to be, oh, God will get us out of this. Don't worry. This is all predicted. This is the second coming. This is some of their arguments, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
That
pray harder.
The reason a lot of people believe in God, they don't necessarily believe in God, but they don't want to face death.
Yeah.
And no life after death. Yeah. They don't want to face that. It's easier to believe in God or pretend to and just don't think about it. I think that happens
a lot. So do we have a counter argument as atheists against that fear? Because it seems so intrinsic in being human.
Yeah.
You know, that our
we must be here for something, for some reason.
But, I don't know.
If you have enough money, you can go to Alcor and get frozen.
Yeah.
Cross your fingers.
But to me, the concept of eternity is equally as frightening in heaven as it is in hell. You know, after your first trillion years in heaven, and you're now proficient in every musical instrument you've ever wanted to learn. You haven't even scratched the surface.
Sounds pretty boring.
It doesn't matter how you conceptualize the hereafter. It seems like it's equally as terrifying.
Yeah, I read an interview with this existential psychiatrist in the Silicon Valley area. The name now slips. Anyway, he's in his 80s now, and he's sort of wrapping up his life. And somebody interviewed him and said, what comes after? And he said, and this one really sticks with me, what comes after is the same thing that came before. it's sort of like that places you in the whole universe, you know. Yeah. What else is there?
Yeah, do you remember things before you were born?
No.
But non-existence is a lot easier to think of before you're born than after you're born.
Right.
It's a challenge. I think it's a challenge for us because we're now hitting people, I have no idea, how I will face my own mortality, with logical grace, or whether, it's the old foxhole atheist thing, isn't it?
Okay, I believe.
Hedge your bet, it's like, well, what harm can it do?
If a priest comes over you and says, it's your last chance, just say I believe or whatever, then whatever they do, I don't know what they do.
We had a discussion.
You might be tempted.
Several months in our group up in Salem when I was up there, and most of the people were satisfied with the idea that you're, whatever you remain at death, is either buried, which is not the normal any longer, or burned, your atoms and so forth are returning to the earth from whence you came, you could be a star or some part of the stellar outside, and that was satisfactory to almost all the people. There's no need to see. The interest in seeing other people, which is part of that belief, but basically people were happy with the idea. Well, I'm going to be a part of the future in some way, small way.
I heard an interesting argument today about what happens if you're eaten by a cannibal and then you die. What happens to you? Because now your substance is now part of that cannibal. whose body now is...
Double-soul person for a while, right?
And the same thing, when you hope to see, the hope that you will see your loved ones again... will granny still be granny, or will she be?
I think the cannibal case, doesn't take too long before you come out the other end.
So, there's research that indicates that there's quite a number of people who attend church and are members, but don't really believe, but they're there for other reasons. The social reason, the activity.
The social reason, I think, is a big thing. Yeah.
Or the there's things yeah. always, I mean, there are, you're doing something all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, they kept you busy in the Mormon church, I think.
They do.
You said four times a week.
Yeah.
I mean, you always have something to do, some activity to go and take care of. Don't have time to sit around and think too much.
Idle hands are the devil's workshop.
Yeah.
They believe that. Keep busy.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think as atheists we really offer anything positive to replace the things we're removing. And I think that's a real challenge for us.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the few social outlets for atheism. but it'll never be as compelling as, you know, the organization that's had, you know, thousands of years to develop, you know, around the institution of a church.
Well, the people who go to church are dogs and atheists are cats.
Yeah. and organizing atheists,
yeah, organizing atheists
is like free adults is like herding cats.
Cats, right.
Because it is difficult when you define yourself by a lack of something.
Right.
By a lack of belief, rather than something positive, that you have something to offer that is positive to counter the illogical positive of the other side. You know, I mean, they've got the answers.
Right.
You know, we're just saying, well, your answer's phony, and you're going to feel worse after we've taken them away from you. You know, that comfort is gone.
Right. With religion, you know, I think people are being kept busy, and there are reasons for that. They're usually of a financial or power nature. So but what an atheist, I think, has to offer essentially is time, because you know, if you do not believe in this gobbledygook, you know, then you want to think, at least I think you do. What can you do to make life better? And to make life better, that is not just for yourself, but you know, you have to make life better for everyone. And that way your own life gets better as well. Sometimes you even get rewarded for doing that, but you cannot, and this is what, you know, the many religious people, who also happen to be oftentimes Republicans, they make life better for themselves, not for others.
And the question of identity too, when we identify as an individual.
I don't as a Catholic or a Protestant. You identify as someone who has this big yacht or who has five cars or something like that.
But your soul is unique. Right, you have an identity that is unique.
But as an atheist, stamped with I don't believe in things like that.
No, and as atheists, but we have to recognize, you know, with the, you know, we're all part of the future, that we belong to a greater whole. And I'm not sure how we do that. How do we, you know, is our ego really the thing that's tripping us up? And you get, you know, people like Sam Harris and his meditation. To try and with thought, try and attack the very ego that is really getting us to cling on to our own individual identity, which is what we lose when we die. I mean, what else do we lose? All your atoms, you don't lose them. I mean, they're just part of something else, but the pattern, our pattern, you know, forms our identity. I find meditation just about impossible. My mind is just a little too
going somewhere.
Yeah, you know, and you know, the fact that I've got to recognize and bring it back, like, well, what for? You know, like, I don't know. I'm not finding any great calmness or any.
Might make a good thought.
I but I'm not. I don't believe I'm in control of the thoughts that appear. You know what I mean?
I'm just going to say, you're assuming that you are in control until you die. And that is a very large assumption. You know, I just had this experience with my wife, and she was a true atheist. And life was over. She didn't want anymore.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. I mean, there was no fight, no, mm-hmm. This was it, guys.
Did she tell you that?
Well, she couldn't talk anymore. She did ask me to help her die, and I couldn't do it. That's why, and she actually begged me to help her die 4 nights in a row. I mean, if you want to hear something bad,
it is.
But the thing is, she then decided, well, okay, I have nothing to live for, so she quit eating,
right.
Quit drinking, basically, and then finally quit taking medication and. And the medication was given, at regular intervals. And the last time, she couldn't talk anymore. She clenched her teeth because she was lucid. She was not like she didn't know what was happening.
Uh-huh.
And this is how it goes, And I'm not saying that any one of you are gonna have the same experience, but the thing is that you're out of control when you're dying.
Sure, yeah, and you know, is the end or the moment when we decide that, we do some cost-benefit analysis between the quality of life we have and the reason to continue on. We're all going to draw that line somewhere differently.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine. I think until you're actually in that position, I'm not sure whether you can imagine being given that sort of that or recognizing that terminality with such finite knowledge that it will happen within this time frame. I mean, I don't live thinking about my death, but I'm sure if I only had a few days to go, it would be on my mind. And no matter how much I think about, let me pretend that I've only got 4 days to go, I can't do it. I don't know what will happen when that moment comes.
Well, you're in pain, for instance.
Yeah.
You may wish to be dead.
Oh, I'm sure. But I can't imagine it. Ego that won't allow it all.
Yeah, you just can't get there.
No, I know.
I'd like to make 2 comments. One is there's this wonderful movie, which I highly recommend to everybody, called About Alice. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I've heard of it.
It's really good. It addresses all of these issues.
She was dying of
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's, yeah.
And she was preparing to take care of herself.
It's a great movie.
Okay.
And the other thing I'd like to tell people about is there's this website called The Peaceful Pill.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of that.
I subscribe to that.
And it's all the different ways you can off yourself, and they rate them in terms of effectiveness, pain, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's very enlightening, and I recommend you find the website, The Peaceful Pill.
Yeah, they publish it via, you can buy the book either hardback or you can buy it on the
online. Yeah.
If you buy the online version, you have it for, I think, 3 or 4 years, and it gets updated.
Right.
So, they have some interesting
So it's
cases.
A book and a website?
Right.
Yeah. But you have to buy...
The movie is called All About Alice?
No, the movie's called About Alice.
About Alice.
And the website and the book is called Peaceful Pill.
Yeah.
Oh, just About Alice?
About Alice.
About Alice, okay.
Yeah. It's got the woman in it is really, I don't remember her name right now. But she's a very famous actress.
Yeah.
But it was a very compelling movie.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah,
So do we have to offer these kind of things to people that are leaving the religion?
It's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, what
it's
they,
a good question.
What will they need?
It's atheism has always had that problem, being defined as a lack of something. What do we have to offer positively?
Truth.
To replace... Well, that's a good point.
Truth.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And instead of imagining...
Well, that leads to my question, and it appears to me... Well, I gave up religion at 14, but I gave up not just religion, I gave up all BS. Everything that didn't make sense, I just dropped it out of my life. Like people today think of Trump as a savior. My brain doesn't need that kind of BS. You know, people think that all jobs are respectable, even if you're destroying value. My brain doesn't need that. So I assume your brains are similar. You don't have that longing, that need for BS that religious people have, a lot of political people, et cetera, normal people. So if they have a need for BS, and we're offering non-BS, then it's
Julianne Moore, that's the one, yeah.
It's unwinnable. So you just have to... I think you have to feed them something that for them seems like BS, but actually inside it's truth.
I'll put it on my cell phone.
It's still Alice, not about Alice. Still Alice with Julianne Moore.
It's what?
Still Alice.
Yeah. Oh, still Alice.
I have seen that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
So if people need BS, our options are limited. I have to give them something that looks like BS, but it's actually true.
So if we can justify other BS based on what is good for the outcome of human existence, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number, then it's acceptable. Is it acceptable to lie, or is the truth just so compelling that we must adhere to?
You have to tell the truth. You have to tell the truth, otherwise they're gonna. If you start lying, how can you tell the difference?
Yeah, but it's not that. Between telling the truth in your language versus telling the truth in their language.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
But I mean, we're living in times of great epistemological crisis, right? You know, we're living in a post-truth era, whatever that means. You know.
I think your best bet at convincing somebody is to, if you can just get them to start to question, then you have a shot. If there's no room for asking questions in their framework, then just don't bother.
Has anyone actually succeeded in?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. But that's why I said before, it wasn't arguing. It was, you know, sharing meals and things like that.
Yeah.
Them getting to know you. And then trusting you and seeing, well, you're right, you know, and I should tone it down or modify it or whatever. But it was through personal relationships. It wasn't through arguments and facts.
Well, how about utilizing humor?
And humor.
We watched the other night, Where to Invade Next with Michael Moore.
Uh-huh.
And really, he gets to this whole thing, the global, you know, caring for the world and each other, and how well they're doing it, let's say, in Iceland.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a religious thing. It's really socialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, democratic socialism.
Yeah.
And so there is a way to do it without having to do it through religion or non-religion. As he really points out very well.
I'm sure everyone's seen The Invention of Lying, the Ricky Gervais.
Isn't Iceland the biggest atheistic country in the world or something like that?
It's one.
Which country?
For sure.
Iceland.
Oh, Iceland?
I don't know. They have a high number of... Is it Lutheran? What's the one from...
Lutheran, yeah.
Yeah, the Danish, whatever the Danish...
Netherlands?
Greenland?
No, well, it was a Danish colony, right?
Greenland was, yeah.
Iceland
too.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I think they have a high number of...
They believe in Odin.
And Thor.
Well, there's nothing in the you know, and I pointed this out to Theus, that, you know, the first
the first commandment lets you know, you know, that you'll have no other gods before me, is that there is this implication that other gods exist.
Oh, yeah.
So chew on that one. So it's okay, you know, you can, you know, believing in Odin and believing in Yahweh is, you know, are completely compatible. Just don't put Odin in front of Yahweh.
I just believe in one less god than you.
Yeah. I just believe in a different order. Yeah, I mean, basically, all religions are just an ordered.
Yeah.
Well, all, because I think it's called I can't remember the name of where the Christians that believe in multiple gods.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly compatible with Christianity. In fact, not only is it compatible, it's really dictated.
Christian Hindus.
Well, it doesn't really matter. You can believe in, you know, Krishna and Ganesh and all of them, because the first commandment recognizes their existence. And to me, that's always been a great argument with theists, saying, have you ever considered changing the order for a weekend just to see how it goes? Because it's...
I got a question.
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody else read anthropology? Because when you read anthropology, you don't come across religious wars. They don't really have religion in the sense that we do, competing beliefs. They just have an assumption that everything's alive. And they have different names and different stories, but they don't kill each other over beliefs. They don't... I mean, it's just totally different. You can imagine how different. So the question is, when did humans start killing each other over beliefs? What year was that? And why did it suddenly become so important that was not important before?
Well, actually, they started killing each other
with Christianity
for breeding privileges. That was the first one.
Yeah.
And then they needed resources.
Yeah, hunting ground and stuff like that.
There's a book I've read a couple times. It's not particularly well written. It's called simply Denial. And it brings out the point that several people have made, that man is the only animal that knows that he personally is going to die. And that this information was so terrible when he came to that awareness that he will do almost anything to escape that knowledge, to escape that, you know, and I have to wonder if religion wasn't an evolutionary necessity. And, you know, it's long past the time to get rid of
retire
it.
Retire it,
You changed it. My God. You changed it from red to white.
Right?
I'm now a believer.
You're a believer.
I saw it with my own eyes.
I challenge your assumption that the humans are the only ones that know and died.
Yeah.
I know that among the animals, elephants, you know, have been observed that when they their time to die comes, they go back to a certain place, probably where they're born or something. And anyway, and they just go there, and then they die. And you know, of course, they're being hunted, so that may change the pattern. But if left alone, I mean, this has been observed.
Well, that's been
we'll never know whether that's instinct or whether that is.
Yeah. I mean, there may
be other animals, but they can't talk to us.
No, yeah. We'll never know.
We might know eventually.
Yeah,
we
can communicate with our eyes, but
right now we can't.
But
dolphins, for example.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and dolphins. But I mean, and this is just kind of my own feeling, that I think there are animals that know that, you know, like others in their own species die.
Well, they don't want to die.
No, but
they don't have that consciousness.
They don't have that. You know, you see another of your species die, Yeah, but the next thought is, I could die. And that's the horrible part. And it's,
but that's also largely a cultural thing. You know, when you, if you look at the science fiction stuff, Klingons love to die. And, you know, they think, so, they think it's, you know, great and wonderful.
Well, yeah.
And so it's,
yeah, and,
it's,
and the Muslims are going to get 72
words. Right, exactly. So,
which after lost them for an eternity.
You know, I just don't know though, if we aren't wasting our time trying to talk about religions and, you know, who is right and who is wrong and whether I should convince you or anybody that you should see things my way and that sort of thing. Particularly where we're all facing this thing about global warming. You know, we're at a point now where scientists have determined times that I read, and this may have changed, but probably made things even worse, but I read that exactly 10 years from now. And I read that a couple of years ago. I mean, it was not exactly 10 years then, but it happens to be 28. They say at the current rate of polluting the atmosphere, there will be so many pollutants in this, the CO2 level will be so high that it will take, even if you could stop coal, adding the first, you know, CO2 molecule, whatever, into the atmosphere, it would still take at least 1,000 years before things would start to participate out, and or precipitate, I would say. And so that means that we have about 10 years, and after that our fate is sealed.
Yes.
And not just humanity, but anybody who breathes air, that includes all the so-called animals, because we don't consider ourselves an animal. But
I do.
Well, yeah, I do too.
Most probably don't.
Yeah, but you know, I think that we are the only animal, if you will, with enough brains to know that what we could do, and we have already all the technology that is necessary to avoid this thing from happening. It's already there. I mean, solar panels know how to transform airflow and for that matter water flow into energy, and so we could continue to live pretty much the way we do.
But I got 2 points to that. One is that I don't think there's many don't know the dire situation we're in, but it rarely rises to the top on anyone's political platform. We rarely, you know, we're not hounding senators.
Bernie Sanders, when they asked him what was the most important thing facing the world, he said global warming.
Yeah. But he would never...
He wasn't elected president.
Yeah. but it's difficult to get some rallying cry behind something that is...
It's
the biggest existential problem we have.
It's not going to affect you next year.
No. Plus the fact, you know, I challenge people who say, save the planet. It's like, well, the planet's going to be fine. We're going away.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, I think changing the mindset to make it a little more personal.
Right.
You know, and I'm, you know, I'm all for, you know, I'm not for saying, you know, give other species a chance. Let them see what the cockroaches can do. They'll do fine. They'll do just, you know.
The same thing occurred to me a few years ago that, people were talking about the planet out of balance or whatever, and I thought, no, it's not out of balance. It's constantly in balance.
Yes,
it may not be what we like, but it's fine. Yeah.
And eventually, the bacteria that can devour polystyrene,
yeah,
and, you know, plastic. Yeah,
awesome. We're not the last creature on Earth.
No,
something else will come along.
Yeah.
I mean, they may have to wait a couple million years, but
The issue, does that raise it to urgency? I know you had something to say. Does that mean this proselytizing of others to make them more scientific is a little more urgent than what we're saying?
Well, it's either a little more urgent or it's a complete waste of time.
I don't know which it is. I always like to tell the young people, we are screwing you so royally.
Yeah.
We have all the oil, all the wear, you know, we're living the good life.
Yeah.
You're screwed.
Yeah.
Do you know how old I'll be in 10 years when this thing fries to a crisp?
and I think that the scientific study that was just published said 20 years. It's 2040 or something. Yeah. It's going to be kind of all over. But I want to go back to something that Henry was saying, that, you know, about what do we have? What do we have? Positive thing. We have, I won't call it truth, we have critical thinking. We have science behind what we believe. And I think that's a big positive thing.
And while I agree with you, my critical faculties lead me to you know, postulate a dire future.
Because of global warming or other reasons?
Well, just, yeah, I mean, I have to admit that the comfort that religion provides for people is tangible.
Yes.
And I don't have it. And instead I have a faculty for critical thinking.
I know, me
too. and I can't escape it.
If you're definitely afraid of death, you're going to grab onto something you can find, unless you can go through some critical thinking and, like you brought up, just an understanding of how the world goes and what is natural, and our atoms are going to go back. I'll be a star one day.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Maybe not one star. I'll be a number of stars.
A part of one.
Death
stars.
Yeah. Death stars.
And one of the things that bothers me sometimes in this business of proselytizing, sometimes I do see people, I know somebody now that I think about this, and they're religious. And, you know, they've come along and, you know, they have a little family and they go to church regularly. And I look, you know, and I know about his religion, and I said, oh, that's not true. But I think, could I make his life better by proving some of this is false? I don't think I could.
That's why I think you need to go to talking about global warming or some other scientifically based subject that you can change their mind on that, and eventually maybe they change their mind on other things.
And if they do change their mind on things that have impact on me, like global warming, or on humankind, I'll try and get myself out of picture, but if it's beneficial, if we can change their positions. And I'm still not sure why Christianity aligns itself with the right and their anti-global warming, that's a complete mystery to me.
They're both illogical.
Yeah.
Pretty clear to me.
Yeah, I read, whether it was yesterday or the day before, but, you know, I got tons of emails that I'm not asking for, but so I work through and I just read the headlines, but there was somewhere that said that Trump had accepted that at the end of this century, the temperature, you know, on Earth will be 7 degrees higher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not fighting it. I mean, you know, and someone today said, you know, that Trump now is no longer saying that global warming isn't true, and maybe that's true in a sense, but
I don't think there's many people.
He's accepting. I mean, he must be religious somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think there's many people now denying global warming.
Well, there's a few.
What they're saying is it's not man-made.
Right, right. Well, that's what Trump is saying, too.
Yes.
He says, yes, global warming is happening, but we don't know the cause.
And what we should do is not attack anything to do with what the potential cause is, to basically mitigate the effect. And Marco Rubio was talking about Florida, because, you know,
yeah,
his backyard's going to disappear shortly, but you know, he says we're all over the mitigation aspect, you know, because we cannot change anything, and he may now be right. It may be too late.
Well, I think it is too late,
and that mitigation is all we can do.
Right, I agree with that.
You know,
yeah, let's get more coal plants.
Yeah.
That's what Trump wants, right? More coal.
Greenhouse gas is good, right? It warms us.
Radiation is healthy.
The plants.
In the blurb you sent out, you asked for examples of, in our personal experience, of, and I have a really, really good one, I think, that you'll appreciate. We were having dinner with some friends of ours, and the wife, my best friend, he's a PhD electric engineer, and his wife isn't so smart. But anyway, we were talking about the store on 17th Avenue, you know, whether it's on the left side or the right side of the street. And she said, oh, it's on the left side. And we said, well, Val, it kind of depends on whether you're coming down the street this way or this way. I mean, if you're coming down the street this way, it's on the right side. If you're coming down the street this way, it's on the left side. She said, no, it's on the left side. And there was no convincing her that it was not on the left side, period. It was on the left side. So that's what you're up against.
Is this Washington, D.C.?
Pardon?
Is this in Washington?
No, it was in San Francisco, and it was a two-way street. So,
well, you know,
there was no. We went through it several times. Look,
really?
Yeah. Look, if you go this way, what side is it? It's on the left side.
But you went about the argument the wrong way. You used to say, "Sure, I always come from the north or whatever."
It's always on her left side, probably.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but that wasn't
and
the issue.
That's the end of the argument, and she would have peace.
Well.
Well, I ran into a situation like that when I was about 8. I had a girl in my class who said, I'm a year older than you. I was born in 50. You were born in 51.
Yeah, she's a year
and
older.
And I said, but you were born in December. I was born in January. You're only 1 month older than me. No convincing her. No, I'm a year older than you. Just, I mean, some people just...
Yeah, there's a wall there that you can't get through.
Yeah.
I was as a kid, I was always curious why a mirror reverses left and right but not up and down. It's like, what's so special about north and south that's different from west and east?
Did you find the answer?
No, I'm still
waiting.
I'm still worried about it.
I want to know.
I decided to delay sideways.
So in the Lake Chapala Society Library, there's two books. One called Natural Atheism, one called Atheism Advanced by David Heller. Is that something anyone in this group put in there, or how did it get there, do you know?
No. Subversive elements in LCS, that's all I can imagine. That's all I can imagine.
Undercover atheists in our community.
We should hunt them down. They were in the new,
really?
On the new shelf, and when I saw them and I read them, I said, well, maybe somebody from this group, or maybe this group, had donated them. I mean, they seem to be... really good books, you know, they've got some good points. And I just thought, well, maybe it's this group, but not, I mean, that's one thing. For a number of years...
There's a lot of other members.
Yeah, I'm just saying, a number of groups around the country have been donating books to the library, and that's not a real straightforward way of impacting people. Here's a book. No, it's in the library. You find it, and you read it, and maybe your life has changed, or your ideas are changed. There seem to be lots of those kind of ways that you can do a little thing.
Good point, Lloyd. I have a half a dozen books that I know I'm not going to reread about atheism that I could donate.
And you know, the atheism section is not that overwhelmed. I would guess not.
Do they have a section?
Careful with donating books to LCS, because if you go in the South Campus, there are boxes and boxes of books waiting to be... sorted and catalogued. You best, if you've got something to donate you want on the shelf, it's best to not drop them off.
But actually
seek. Well, you could put them on the shelf, or they've got to go in the catalogue. But it's to positively seek getting them on the shelf rather than just leaving them. That's there's just...
Really?
In fact, there was a survey with LCS and they said, I donated these books and they never appear on the shelf. And, trying to kill.
Well, yeah. I thought maybe I would thank someone in the group or the group for these books. They were very good.
Volunteer to go help catalog books.
There we go.
Yeah.
And only catalog certain types of books.
They're Christian, yeah. They're not going to grab that atheistic book and slap it on the shelf.
I had a thought once, I was kind of surprised to find out that Habitat for Humanity is a pretty pro-Christian group. And I often thought, actually, retired about
Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought about, you know, volunteering, you know, but I'm going to have to get a T-shirt. So your house is being built by an atheist.
Would we have a problem with positive? Yeah, I consider that group to be a positive impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in sure. general.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that it is religious, is that problematic?
Well, it is, because it pushes the religion. You know, and God did this for
my,
you.
My information is in Salem that the families that benefited from those homes were exclusively.
Oh, were they?
Oh,
okay.
You know, I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah.
That's the information.
Yeah. So there is a danger.
It may be a false feed of information.
Yeah.
But I admire Jimmy Carter, and I admire the fact that he's done that, helping lots of families all around the world, his organizations. Those are the types of things that humanist groups and atheist groups have been trying to do, you know, more of to help people.
No, I think integrity is the desired quality here. I mean, maybe even if you have to eat the wafer.
But if you go to Habitat for Humanity and they're saying, well, with these good deeds, even though that's supposedly not the reason you get into heaven, but with these good deeds, you're guaranteed, you know, eternal bliss in paradise. And the atheist group down the car, well, what are you offering? You know, it's like, oh, well, critical thinking.
Somebody wouldn't tell me that as a good atheist says, who says?
Right.
Well, you're right. I mean,
you're
saying, well, God says.
Yeah, with all of the pluses and minuses related to it.
Anyway. Yes. So I have a feeling we're beating a dead horse.
Yeah. We all have contact with people. We're all, you know, should we be, I mean, the whole point was really, should we be aware of, are there any strategies that we'll be successful in challenging people that we run into? You know, do we have an obligation, or are we fooling ourselves that we can make a difference? Are there strategies that work? Are there some that don't? What? You know, the whole basis was, because I feel compelled, you know, to argue.
I think...
I don't know what I'm doing any good.
Okay, I think, first of all, we have no obligation. If you feel that way, you're pretty much like Don Quixote. I think, you know, the world is...
Maybe you're right.
And
but I'm, so again, I'm not sure how I change myself.
But if it's a one-on-one situation, I think the only way, if you want to have someone change their point of view, I think the only way you can do it is by asking questions. I mean, have people answer the questions.
Be a listener and ask questions.
Exactly. And they have to convince themselves. You cannot do it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Phil, okay. if you're at a dinner with 20 people, and the host says, okay, everybody, it's time to say grace. What do you do?
I usually get my phone out, check my email.
But you don't stand up.
I pick up my glass of wine.
But you don't stand up and say, okay, now I would like to say anti-grace.
No, I don't. I think there's a certain amount of social courtesy that I afford people for saying their little...
Yeah. I often feel like I should.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to stand up and say... Well, you've had your say.
Yeah.
and now it's my turn.
But if it was at my house, then maybe I would
definitely,
you know,
not allow it in my house.
But if it was someone else's, I think just out of social courtesy, I would not.
It's a good way to not get invited back.
Yeah.
I've had a couple times when after grace I said, now I would like to thank the turkey who gave his life and lived under more miserable circumstances than Jesus Christ ever dreamed of.
Yes.
Or thank the people that prepared the
The butcher, the
merchant that brought the things.
I'm sick to death of, and this is a point I make constantly, is that, you know, when you thank God for saving experts, no. thank the doctors, the nurses, the ambulance crew, the police, the, you know, anyone who was involved in resolving that particular issue. They're the heroes.
My question is, why the hell did God put you in that position in the first place?
Yeah, he's responsible for everything. Yeah,
exactly. I mean,
or she, or
yeah. We're not able to fathom the mind of the divine.
You're right.
I say, you know, if the Bible was written by a person, what would be, you know, although we're not allowed to really challenge the mind of God, if it was written by a human, how would you view that human? You know, some sadistic.
Which one?
But I mean, generally speaking, he would be a sadistic, misogynistic. I mean, he could just run through a whole gamut of.
And the first books of the Bible were written 60 to 100 years after Christ supposedly died.
Yeah. Not only that, but it was written by about, I think,
by council,
hundreds of people, really.
Right.
But about 60 people were selected out of that to put what is known as the Bible. To put that together.
And then later on, the Catholic Church organized things to make this Christianity.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what happens when Italians organize things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you better hold your hand on your pocketbook. Anyway.
That reminds me of a joke.
Yeah,
real quick. The difference between heaven and hell.
Yeah.
Have I told this before?
I don't know. I've heard it though. Yeah,
probably
I haven't heard it. Go ahead.
Well, okay. In heaven, the police are British, the lovers are French, the cooks are Italian, and everything's organized by the Swiss. And in hell, the police are French, the cooks are British, the lovers are Swiss, and everything's organized by the Italians.
We usually get the British or lovers, but okay.
You know, I haven't been in London for a very long time, but I understand that things are a little better now.
Could be. They invented those toast coolers, which are fascinating. You know, those racks that they put the toast in when it's hot, within seconds it's ice cold.
No, it was a joke that, you know, the main staple of food in England has been things that live under the ground because it's, you know, the climate isn't really that hospitable for things growing elsewhere. So it's basically your roots, your carrots, your turnips, your potatoes. And then, you know, you to make them edible, you boiled them until
you can chew them.
Until all the nutrition is
inedible.
But the joke was you toss them away and drink the water. Yeah, it's just
it's the way my mother cooked.
Yeah.
You're disgracing my mother.
It's the way I still cook.
You know Michael Rose, who used to come here? He's living now near Birmingham.
Oh, in England?
Yeah, he bought a house.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, in Bellingham, I think it's called. And it's something...
Birmingham, England.
Yeah, England, right.
Okay.
I think it's Bristol. It's near Bristol. It's on the west coast, anyway.
Oh, Birmingham's in the middle. Right smack in the middle of England.
Bellingham?
Birmingham. Are you talking about Bellingham?
No. I think it's Bristol that he said.
Oh, Bristol, okay.
About an hour's drive. But he lives in Bellingham. It's a small town.
Okay.
And it's on the west side of England. Yeah, but can you believe that? I talked to him a couple of days ago and I wondered about the weather.
Yeah.
Well, back to the difference between people and animals, humans are the only species that can blush and should.
They can what?
Blush.
Oh, blush. Yeah, should. Yeah. There was someone saying that they, you know, the story of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge, and that being the end of paradise, is the actual metaphor for discovering our mortality.
Mm-hmm.
That was when that knowledge was when we mm-hmm.
yeah,
we lost that? Bliss.
Say, Adam, you're going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether you're with Steve or whether.
It's, yeah. By the way, I'd like to say that this is a really good meeting and this is a good topic. And
enjoyed
thank you,
it.
Phil.
Yeah.
This is one of the best we've had in a while.
It took me a while.
So take a bow, Phil. Take a bow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, we've got Jeffrey's next next month, right?
Sure.
Okay, you're gonna surprise us with it?
No, I'm gonna look at that.
Well, you can't surprise me because I've got to send the blood into Stephen for. So let me know as soon as you.